Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today. And we are going to talk with you today about your pet's health. And when it comes to the safety of your cat or your dog, I'm sure you'd do just about anything to help them along. And when you're traveling, of course, their safety is especially important. And, of course, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is with us to talk about that today. She is with the School of UW School of Veterinary Medicine, and she takes some time every month to spend with us to give us advice on how to keep our pets healthy and happy. And, Dr. Sandy, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, I love coming here. You know that for me, this is one of the highlights of my month is coming and talking to everyone.
Well, it's great to have you with us. And this whole business about air travel, To be honest, I would have a hard time putting my cats on a plane.
Well, there's kind of two ways of air travel. You either have the pets that are going into the baggage hold area, or you have the pets that are flying on board with you. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is not just because like holidays are upon us and all the heavy travel times, but because the Department of Transportation just released their 2014 study about safety for pets and air travel. And what they found is in the United States, this is just domestic flights, they found that there were 17 deaths, and these are animals that are going in the baggage hold area, and 26 injuries. And
wow.
Most of those injuries were animals that were trying to escape from their carrier. And the deaths were typically either being because they did escape, they ended up getting hit by a vehicle at the airport, or they had, you know, pretty severe travel stress. By that, I mean, overheating, panting and not being able to breathe properly for dogs that are like the bulldog, which are no longer allowed to fly in the belly of the plane, by the way. Because they, you know, dogs like that are going to have a lot of other health risks when they're stressed. United Airlines had the worst record, but, you know, when you start looking at it, it's like, well, they fly the most pets because
right.
they have more flights. So it's really hard to compare airlines. So I thought, you know, this would be a really good time to talk about things that we can do if you have to put your animal in the belly of the plane or even on the plane with you, things that would make it a little bit safer. Number one is if you can leave your pet at home, do that. It's a lot of stress. I mean, we were just talking about flying ourselves, and I was saying how, well, you know, getting to the destination is wonderful, but it's the in-between is, for me, just very stressful and exhausting. And so imagine what it would be like for a pet that doesn't know what's actually going on. You need to make sure that the pet is well adapted to a crate ahead of time, because if you just suddenly bring the crate in, put the pet in the crate, and they don't know what this crate is, that's when they're going to start trying to dig and chew and try to escape. There's a very good email site to go to for looking at what crates work and what don't, which ones are not very safe. And it's the Center for Pet Safety. A few years ago, they did a study looking at seatbelt harnesses and whether they work or not, and have made some big changes in that industry to come up with safer devices for pets, because believe it or not, a couple of years ago, most of the seatbelt harnesses for pets failed when they did crash test type stuff. And they just recently did the same thing looking at crates. And it's amazing how many of the crates that are out there are just, they get crunched. If they slide, they can break. And so I think it's a good place to go if you're looking for a crate, looking at there. It's kind of like Consumer Reports for pets. And so that mm-hmm. would be a place to go to. I still think that even if you get an airline-approved crate and your dog's adapted to it, strange things happen. And I like to see any place you can use cable ties to be able to secure the halves of the crate together and secure the door shut. Obviously, it can be open fairly easily. I even tell people to go as far as taping a small pair of scissors or something mm-hmm. because they're going in the baggage hold. You can do that. Can't take them on the airplane with you, but you can do that. And that way, if your animal is in distress, they're able to get them out, but it will keep the door from flying open and perhaps keep your pet from being one of those 26 that got away and maybe got hit by cars or something while they were at the airport. One of the other things that we are strongly recommending is that we never use any chemical sedation for these dogs. If you start giving them medical management for their anxiety of being in the crate or being away from you or in the belly of the plane, that can drop their blood pressure, interfere with their ability to thermoregulate, and cause more trouble. So again, if your pet is not crate adapted, don't depend on medication. Yeah, you can use things like dog appeasement pheromone, which is a spray that you can use. It sometimes has some calming effect. But any of the stuff that veterinarians can prescribe could potentially cause some trouble. You do need to have a health certificate ahead of time. Airlines require it. And I think it's a good idea. And it's not just jumping through the hoops. What we're doing is making sure that your pet is healthy for travel and is not going to be traveling while they're under quarantine for something or with some contagious disease. So a health check is really important, and make sure that you get that timed appropriately, because health certificates are only good for about 30 days. So if you get it done ahead of time, you may need to find a vet at your destination to redo your health certificate again if you're there for a long period of time. Make sure you bring your vaccine records, even though it should be on the health certificate. It's also helpful to have that. I like to have pets have frozen water in their crate for long flights so that it can slowly melt and not be sloshing around. And then putting a bag of food in a couple of, you know, doubled up Ziploc bags and duct tape it to the top of the crate. That way, if you do get separated from your pet, there's flight delays, something's going on, that way at least they are able to provide your pet with some nourishment that they are used to getting too. So, you know, and if you don't want to go through all that, there's always, you know, first class travel for dogs and cats that don't fit under your seat. Some of the newer things that are available now are these high class pet holding areas right next to you in and the airplanes, and it's only flights between the coasts, and they have to pay for, you pay a first class ticket to have your pet go up there with you, but Ooh. It would be one way of being able to have your pet with you. So and a lot of these things are true for dogs and cats that are traveling under the seat with you. Get them crate adapted first.
Yeah, Coco, one of my cats would meow the whole time and drive everybody nuts.
I know. Yeah, I flew a cat home. I adopted a cat when I was working out in California one time at a meeting. There was a rescue group there, and I bought her an airline ticket and brought her home, and oh boy, you know, she ended up having an accident, and I won't get into it, but let's just say the flight attendant gave me permission to be able to take her back into the restroom and clean her up because we had so many complaints with the odor that was being emitted from under the seat.
Oh, man.
So, those things like that can happen as well. And you know, I think it's just, if you can, leave them at home. I think they'd be happier with that.
We had, along those lines, Gina sent us a Facebook question and said, we have a pug and snub-nosed dogs are prohibited by major airlines. Is there any way to travel with him safely?
That's the problem, is any of these push-faced dogs can overheat very, very quickly. That's why there are temperature embargoes with traveling. If it's going to be, I think it's 80 degrees on either end of the flight, you may not be allowed to be able to put your dog or cat in the belly of the airplane. And when we have wintertime temperatures as well, one of the things that you do have to often sign is a cold adaption certification saying that your pet can withstand temperatures less than 45 degrees. That's a lot of leeway, because what if it's 30 below? Would your pet be able to tolerate that? But you've just signed, yes, under 45 degrees Fahrenheit, my pet can tolerate it. So, I wish that we could travel with something. Like, I would love to be able to take my pets with me, but even just stress of car rides for some, like one of my dogs doesn't like riding in the car. That's why I have a very reliable pet sitter, and he is happier at home.
Ann in Duluth, Minnesota has a question for you. Hi, Ann. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I have just lost an 7-year-old, actually, Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. He was an absolutely delightful dog. I've been told that virtually all of them have issues with heart valves, and I am wondering, is it possible to find breeders who have bred that out, or is it true that I'm going to be taking a chance on that no matter where I find a puppy.
Yeah, this is a really tough breed because they have so many health problems. You're right. One of the major health problems that the Cavalier King Charles Spaniels have is they develop mitral valve disease very early in life and often die of heart failure way too soon. And, you know, and these dogs are, anybody that
they're
doesn't know,
wonderful
they're
dogs.
Just so, they're people oriented. They were bred to be kind of lap dogs and just fun and
oh,
get
yeah.
along with everybody. Lovely, lovely dogs. But they also have some other problems as well. Because of the shape of their skull, their brain is too big to fit in their skull. And a lot of these dogs will have a condition that in the human world is called Carey malformation, where the part of their brain is actually being compressed out of the exit point where the spinal cord joins the brain. And these dogs will come in either with severe neurologic signs or scratching at their neck because of pinched nerves and funny sensations, and often get misdiagnosed as having allergies because they come in and they're just scratch, 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 but it's more the issue of they've got some neurologic issues. And it's, you know, it's a tough one because there's really not a whole lot you can do about it. There may be some surgical intervention, but you'd be working with a veterinary neurologist to be able to get this under control. They also have an issue where the fluid in their balance system in their ear canal, rather than being liquid, becomes gelatinous, and it doesn't allow them to have their balance system work properly, and they will present with head tilts and some pretty bad vestibular disease as well. And then one other little incidental thing that we'll sometimes see, which if you have a Cavalier, it's important that you let your veterinarian know, because if they just do routine blood work for something, many of these dogs will come back with low platelet counts. And platelets are one of those cells that are involved with the clotting system. And it's not that they have low platelets. They just have giant platelets that are, so they are miscounted because instead of having lots and lots of little ones, they have fewer big ones. And I've had these dogs come in to our clinic thinking that, you know, they have some type of a bone marrow issue, and it's actually normal for the breed. So back to your question, what are you going to do if you want to try to find a healthy Cavalier? I think it's important to, when you are working with breeders, make sure that you're going through the family tree and try to go back at least, if you can, 8 generations and find out what they died from.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, so it's you want to really work with somebody that knows their dogs, follows them along, and so that you can, you know, say, this, you know, these are the ones that died early. There are some heart registries. The Orthopedic Foundation for Animals, OFA, as well as there's the veterinary, I can't remember what their little code number is, but or they're the letters they use, an acronym. It's Veterinary Cardiology Association does heart certification as well. But the problem is these dogs may test normal early and sound normal as a puppy and even maybe reach that breeding age and be normal. And yet then later on when they're 5, 6, 7, 8 years of age, as your dog did, develop heart disease. And meanwhile, they've already got puppies out there and are passing this potential problem on. So, that's why it's really imperative to go with somebody that's been breeding for a long time and knows what is going on with their dogs.
Mm. Okay.
All right.
I'm sorry for
you.
Your loss.
Yeah.
It's a tough one. And I know one of my daughters, her friend has one of these dogs, and I just recently diagnosed it with heart disease as well. And
it's a
tough thing to be able to tell them, because for 4 years, no problem. And
no
all
problem.
Of a sudden, boom, we got an issue.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you, Ann, for calling. I appreciate your call very much. We had an email question from Carrie that goes back to air travel, so I wanted to bring that up. She's thinking of getting an autism service dog for her son. Can you address travel for service dogs? Do they still need a health certificate?
I assume that they will need a health certificate. But I don't know for sure. This would be something I would be checking with the airlines. But service dogs are going to be allowed on. They usually, at least the ones that I've seen on board, give you one of the bulkheads areas so that the dog can be at your feet in that area, and that, you know, maybe something that you would want to look into with the airline. Sometimes they only allow so many pets on board, whether that be people that are paying to have their pet in the, you know, under the seat with them. There's often limitations because they just don't want to have a zoo on board. That wouldn't be fun for everybody. So you may be sometimes a little limited as to what flight you can go on, but probably not. I mean, I would think that hopefully the American with the Disability Act would protect you and allow you to be able to get on the plane. But this is a huge issue. The state of Florida just is got hefty fines for people that are faking service dogs.
Oh.
If you just go online, you can buy service dog credentials and put it on your dog.
You're kidding.
No, vests, certificates, patches, all these things to say, yes, this is a service dog, when really it's just your pet and you want them traveling with you. And it's against the law to ask, well, what is your disability? And so it's a really touchy place. Oh. But if you get caught, you know, forging documents that you have a service dog, I don't know what the fine was, $10,000, something like that.
Wow.
But pretty hefty fine, yeah.
Well, and deserved.
I know. Yeah.
As a matter of fact. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Rebecca Haas, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Now, though, we're talking about your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. And we have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on our Facebook page, and I always love photos. So if you've got a pet photo and a question, or just the pet photo, that's fine too. Or just the question, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title. Donna in Bailey's Harbor up next with a question. Hi, Donna. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. I will be traveling soon with the English Cocker Spaniel. He's flown various times in a crate underneath. And the vet before had said that Benadryl was a good thing to give him, and we have given him that before. Are you saying that absolutely no medication? And what's your opinion of using the Benadryl?
Well, Benadryl, as if you're using it as a drug to sedate your dog, most dogs that are really anxious are just going to override it. It may make them a little sleepy, but you know, it would be generally considered safe. But if you've got a dog that is afraid in the crate, or you know, is you know, showing signs of stress, but don't get fooled thinking that if I give my dog Benadryl, they'll do well. They'll just override it. So anytime you're going to be using a drug for travel, I mean, even car travel, I always recommend doing a dry run at home to see what kind of side effects the dog's going to have. Because some of the drugs we use, like the benzodiazepines, like Valium and Xanax and things like that in pets, which can be very effective for decreasing anxiety. Not that I would use them when a dog is traveling on an airplane or a cat on an airplane, but you know, for maybe car travel, it would be fine. There's a small percentage of dogs that will actually have a paradoxical effect. And by that, I mean, instead of being kind of quiet and mellow and I just don't care what's going on, they're bouncing off the walls. So if you waited to give that drug to your dog before and you know, right before you went on your trip, you may have several hours of having a dog in the car that's just, you know, doing laps around it. So always do a dry run at home if you can.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Facebook question from Tricia. I have a 12-year-old American Eskimo with a diagnosed partially collapsed trachea, high blood pressure. It was treated with
enalapril.
Enalapril, okay. And no obvious signs of enlargement via X-ray. Any thoughts regarding treatment options, surgery perhaps?
Yeah, well, the high blood pressure is something that is totally unrelated to the issue with the collapsing trachea. We'll see collapsing trachea due to a couple of reasons. One is just the anatomical change variants that we see in dogs. Some dogs are blessed with, instead of having kind of rigid tracheal rings, those cartilage rings that keep our airway open and their airway open, they're softer. And so when they get excited, they're breathing faster, their trachea can close down. But we'll sometimes also see dogs that have underlying heart disease with heart enlargement as that heart gets bigger, it starts pushing on those main airways and can cause the dog to have some coughing associated with that and some airway distress as well. So I'm not sure if that's what she was talking about with, you know, taking a chest x-ray, no sign of enlargement. I would assume she meant heart enlargement. But we, you know, blood pressure in dogs is one of those interesting things. You know, we can, in humans, you can be hypertensive and yet be healthy because we know it runs in families. It's, you know, familial hypertension. But in pets, we will often only see it when it's associated with various medical conditions, usually things like Cushing's disease, which is overactive adrenal glands. Kidney disease would be another reason for it. Those are probably the two big things that we get concerned about. So I'm not sure if your veterinarian has gone through a workup to rule out those types of things, but that may be something that you'd want to have evaluated to see, sure, does your dog have some underlying reason for the hypertension?
Makes sense.
But really, for trachea issues like that, surgery, I mean, yes, there are stents and things like that that can be put in, but it's major surgery, and most people just manage it medically and by keeping the pet slender, limiting using a collar and using a harness over their chest instead, you know, just monitoring exercise and excitement and that kind of thing.
Patricia in Madison has a question for you, so let's go to her. Hi, Patricia.
Hello. I have a question about oral hygiene in dogs and cats. There are additives you can buy that you sprinkle on their food that are supposed to help with, they're supposed to be anti-plaque and anti-tartar, such as Clensident. Do those help?
What I always tell people to do is to be able to determine if something is going to help your pet or not is to refer to the Veterinary Oral Health Council. It's like the American Dental Association, but in the veterinary world. And it's the VOHC.org. And they have products listed on there. And it's a couple of pages of things where they don't do the research, mm-hmm, but they evaluate the research that is presented by the company to them and to say whether they're going to be helpful for, you know, controlling tartar and plaque, that type of thing. And to my knowledge, this sprinkle-on easy way out doesn't work very well. There's water additives. They don't work very well. There's a couple that are on the list of approved things that they've shown may be helpful, but you have to be careful. There are some water additives out there that, that have a chemical in it called xylitol, and xylitol is actually the active ingredient to help keep plaque from building up, and we have it in our sugarless gums and things like that. That can be very toxic to dogs, and even though it's sold, and it's sold through reputable veterinary companies with xylitol in it, it's supposed to be mixed at very precise amounts so that you don't overdose your dog. And so, again, it's kind of, you know, knowing what your dog will tolerate when it comes to, will your dog tolerate brushing? Would it be easier to use some of the dental chews? By far, brushing is your best way of controlling plaque and tartar on your dog's teeth. But there's a new dog treat that Mary L. was supposed to have launched this summer, and we're still waiting to be able to get it at the vet school, so it's a couple of months late, but they're called the Oravet Chews, and they've been shown to be really effective at keeping that fuzzy stuff that we get every morning on our teeth off your dog's teeth. And
what
that's what... or cats. Well, they're just labeled for dogs. For cats, you're a little more limited. There are dental diets. There are some, like, oral rinses and things you could use. There's some oral treats that may be helpful, but it comes down to good old brushing is one of your best things to consider having done. And if you can start when they're young and make it a fun experience for them, a lot of cats will tolerate it.
Mm-hmm. We use a chew for the kitties,
mm-hmm,
I think, based on our last time we had them in for...
Are they the ones that look like a Vienna sausage? The big snow?
No,
okay.
Not that big.
Okay.
They're about that long.
Yeah,
about
the little...
an inch long.
The greenies, the greenie chews. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Greenies is one of the treats that is for cats on the VOHC kind of approved list. So that might be another thing to consider trying. But remember, that's only going to affect the chewing teeth, which are their back premolars and molars, and not those front incisors and canine teeth. They're
okay.
Just not going to be using those. So if you have to brush anywhere, you brush up front and use the treats and food for the back.
Let's, again, Patricia, thank you so much. Appreciate it. David wonders if melatonin is okay for his dog's anxiety.
Melatonin is one of those things that people will take for like jet lag and things. And we've actually found that there's been a couple of reports of using it for dogs with noise phobias, thunderstorm phobias, and, you know, anything like any other like fireworks and things like that. And it's been found to be helpful for some of those dogs. So we know that there is research based on that. But for other types of anxiety, I don't know. Okay. It's available over the counter. It would be something that would be very safe to try. I use it fairly frequently in geriatric patients that have some cognitive decline and maybe changes in their sleep-wake cycle, and they start getting like nocturnal anxiety. That's been quite helpful to be able to use that as for them. But I have to know more about your dog as to whether the type of anxiety your dog is showing, it would be helpful or not.
Mark in Hickson has a question. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Oh, good morning. I have a nine-month-old yellow lab female, and I'm wondering what the appropriate weight for her should be.
Oh, that's, you know what? It's really tough to be able to tell you a weight. That would be like saying, what would be the appropriate weight for a, you know, 20-year-old woman? Well, is she 5 foot tall, 6 foot tall? You know, labs come in all different shapes and sizes. And so instead of looking at what would be an appropriate weight, I would be looking at what is her body condition score. And you can look this up online, you know, canine body condition scoring. And there's two methods that it's done. There's on a scale of 1 to 5 is one method. Most veterinarians use a scale of 1 to 9, where 1 is the walking skeleton and 9 is the morbidly obese dog. Where we want to see a dog is in that 4 to 5 range, a slender to, like, you know, average. And keeping her in that range where she still has a visible waist, you can feel ribs but maybe not see them, that she doesn't have a fat pad on her lower abdomen. And remember, dogs carry their fat in different places. Some will carry it up more on the front of their chest over their sternum. So I think this would be something that the next time you are visiting your veterinarian, say, can you please do a body condition score for me? Interesting, though, when I have had owners do their own, I present them with a chart and say, tell me where you think your dog is. The great majority of them give their dog a better score than they should have. What I think is, you know, a 7 or an 8, they're putting as maybe, oh, they're just a little overweight. They're a 6. Anytime we go from like a 5 to a 6, that means they're 10% over their ideal body weight. So 7 would be 20% over and 8 would be 30% over. So so we have to really have the patient in front of us to be able to know what's an appropriate weight for them. So I'm sorry I can't answer your question.
Okay, well, here's another one quickly. If we decide to have her bred, approximately how old should a dog be?
Well, you want to wait until they are socially mature, so about 2 years of age.
Okay.
And being a Labrador Retriever, there's a whole bunch of hoops that you should be jumping through to make sure that she is the best breeding stock that you can use, and that you're going to want the sire to have gone through all this as well. You'll want to have her hips checked. There's a couple of different methods for doing hips. There's the OFA, which is the Orthopedic Foundation for Animals method. That's done when they're 2 years of age. And then there's another method that you could do actually now that's called pen hip, and that can be done, I think, starting at about 16 weeks of age and up. So that would be a different method. You would have to find a veterinarian that's gone through the special training to be able to do that type of x-ray, though. Not everyone is able to take them and interpret them. You probably want to have her shoulders and elbows checked, since they are prone to bony changes in those areas as well. I would also have her genetically checked for exercise-induced collapse, EIC. It's a genetic test that you can have run. And you'd want to have her vision checked as well, because they have a number of different inherited retinal changes, and that means you would have to find a board-certified ophthalmologist for doing what's called a SERF exam, and that stands for Canine Eye Registration Foundation. And a lot of times they do those at dog shows. I know our some of our ophthalmologists will go to local dog shows and just, you know, do all these eye checks in a trailer or another room someplace at the show so that people can get their pets certified. So lots of hoops to jump through. If one of my clients was saying, I want to buy a dog from someone and they haven't done that, I'd be saying, look elsewhere. Because that's why we see so many Labrador Retrievers with these inherited problems. Sad, I just had a lab, very nice, very sweet lab in, about a year ago. She came in as an eight-week-old puppy and was okay. By 12 weeks, she was blind because she had inherited retinal dysplasia. And the breeder, it was just a backyard breeder that put their dog together with another dog. Yeah, they both were nice-looking labs. They both had AKC papers, which just means you've got their birth certificate or their family tree. Doesn't tell you about health. And that poor lady is now living with a blind, very active dog.
No.
Yeah.
So lots to think about, Mark. It's good to get this out.
You have to. And, you know, I tell people that if I was looking for a guarantee from a breeder, I would want a very simple guarantee, and that is lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
What do I mean by that? I mean that I want to make sure the breeder is making sure they're breeding the best dogs that they can, that they are also making sure that the dog is going to appropriate homes so that they're not adopting a dog out to somebody that isn't going to provide this dog with the exercise and training needs and lifestyle needs that the dog may need. So that just to give you an example, we had an elderly person that the family went out and bought her as a gift, a German Shepherd puppy.
Oh.
And she can't walk the dog. She can't train the dog, and the dog didn't last very long. It was rehomed fairly quickly into a home where somebody could take care of it. Whose problem is it? That was the breeder's problem, because they should have known better. Where is this dog going? And really grilled the family so that it wasn't going to get put back into the German Shepherd rescue situation. So it's very simple, but that's what you want, a reputable breeder that wants to be there for you for the rest of the dog's life and help you any way they can.
And again, Mark, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lots of good information there. Andrew and Verona, your turn next. Hi, Andrew. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. First, I'd like to thank Dr. Sawchek for assisting me with my CBT internship at the hospital.
Oh, all right. Yes.
And so we have moved, and we have three dogs, and that includes a 5-acre prairie with manicured trails. And our dog's favorite new hobby is snatching up and gobbling any scat they can find that's not their own.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, that's...
And I'm aware of the concerns. I'm aware of... possibility to control them, but I was wondering what your thoughts are as far as the effectiveness and humanity of just using basket muzzles, because we really like to keep them off leash in the field.
Yeah, basket muzzles, there are two types of muzzles that you can buy. One that you've probably seen at veterinary clinics, which are made out of nylon. They are meant to keep the mouth shut so that you can get a procedure done and not have the dog bite you. They're meant for short-term use, not for exercise, because the dog can't pant effectively in it. They can't drink water. They can't take treats. Basket muzzles, like you would see with working dogs, like some of the police dogs and things, they can still pant and function, so they're not going to overheat. But I have seen dogs still go out and with a basket muzzle on, and now you've just got a basket muzzle filled with whatever fecal material they found, and you know it's a mess because they're still going to try to eat it. They can push it through, so. This is a tough one, but I think what I would be recommending is, number one, brushing your pet's teeth, okay, just for the aesthetics and hygiene issues, making sure that your pet is on at least a monthly deworming program, and that can be associated with your heartworm preventative. Probably the worst scat that your dogs could eat that could be a health risk for you and for them, for that matter, are raccoon droppings. Raccoons have a roundworm that's called Bayless ascaris, and it's a roundworm that if we are exposed to the infective form, which the dog can be shedding in their fecal material, It has a predilection to migrate to our brain, and it leaves a real nasty path of destruction. Having your dogs on year-round heartworm preventative that includes a deworming agent, so either something like ivermectin with pyrantel, which is like HeartGuard or Iverheart, or something like Sentinel or Interceptor that will get roundworms, hookworms, and whipworms would be really helpful as well. So I think, you know, that's what I would do rather than be putting a muzzle on them, because it's not going to stop them. It's going to just make it harder for them to get at and more work for you with the cleanup. Yeah.
Oh, boy. There you go, Andrew. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And lots of callers. The number to call, by the way, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. And if you got a photo of your pet, we'd certainly love to see that as well. Jeanette in La Crosse up next. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. I was calling to see what you thought about. I was looking at a puppy, you know, from a Chihuahua puppy from a faraway state. And they say that they would fly the puppy to me, and it's... Is that safe for a little dog like that?
You know, anytime you're flying juveniles, it is extremely stressful for them. And plus, you're buying a puppy sight unseen. Okay, you can look at pictures online, but what you really need to do is before you even look at a puppy, you want to see mom and dad. Okay, you want to make sure that they are physically fit, socially, adapted to everything, friendly, that you're not working with a puppy mill that is just trying to make a buck. There are Chihuahua breeders locally that you could go to, but if it's that important to you to work with that breeder, I think it'd be worth the car trip there. I would not be recommending that pet be flown. One of the last dogs that I just had in to see me that had been shipped from a southern state, it was a bulldog, and how they got it on an airplane, I have no idea, but it was shipped up here sight unseen. The people paid $9,000 for this puppy, and wow. The dog has every birth defect you can think about, including ended up developing pneumonia with all the stress of flying. So if you can, buy locally, know the breeder, go to some dog shows, you'll see dogs there, you'll be able to meet, breeders within good driving distance from you. But if you really want to work at this one, go for a drive and take a vacation. And you'll have several days then coming home to be able to bond with your pet in a non-stressful car environment.
Suggestion. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Net as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along, and certainly great to have you listening in and calling 1-800-642-1234. Lisa in Minocqua up next. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a kitty. She's about 4 or 5 years old. She gets vaccinated, she's bay, but I let her out about an hour every day all summer, and I noticed she's breaking out with scabs all over, and it's not her cat food because I've experimented with that, and just wondering, maybe she picked something up outside.
Well, one of the most common reasons why we see, especially this time of the year, cats breaking out in little scabs all over their body, it's given the name miliary dermatitis. I don't know why they call it that. I guess because the scabs are about the size of a millet seed. But the number one reason is flea allergy dermatitis. And do you have your cat on a flea treatment?
Well, that's the thing. I did do a little research, and I finally started about 2 weeks ago on the Advantix.
Okay, and so that is probably what's going on. Now, it could be allergies to other things in the environment, pollens, molds, and so on. But I would have expected that to have started maybe a little bit earlier in the cat's life. I just did a community dog day event for Dane County Humane Society on Saturday, where we had 106 dogs come through and got vaccinated and microchipped and a physical exam and everything, and a wonderful community event. But about half the dogs I saw had fleas. And this is the flea season, because it's what we'll see is the numbers start out in kind of low in the spring and summer, and then gradually build up in the environment. And a pet that's going outside in like late August, September, early October, if they're not on flea preventive, they're going to get fleas. And remember, cats groom them off, so you may not even see fleas on your cat. And the fleas that you may be seeing are actually from eggs that were laid a couple of months ago. So if you've got a flea problem, you're looking at a minimum of 3 months of using a product like you're using. Hopefully you're not using Advantix, because Advantix is a dog product that is lethal for cats. You want to use Advantage, okay? If you're using Advantix, it's got permethrin in it, and that is extremely toxic for cats. Don't use that. But Advantage would be fine, or Advantage Multi, which is something you can get from your veterinarian.
Yep, I have Advantage too on them, so I'll just keep treating her and everything else around her.
Yep, treating all the pets in the household. Treating the environment in your house is probably not necessary, but you could probably get by with just vacuuming thoroughly. Oh, yeah. But be on the lookout outside for sources of fleas, things like raccoons, possums that may be coming by and coming through your yard. Stray cats are one of the other big sources as well. Rabbits and squirrels and things, they have their own fleas, and it's uncommon to see them be transferred to our pets. It's usually the animals I just mentioned, raccoons, possums, and other stray cats and dogs.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. I just keep the cat in.
I know. That's the safest place for the cat, is to be inside. And you can. There's a wonderful resource for people that is called the Indoor Cat Initiative. And it is, I think it's Cornell University is doing that. But if you go to just Indoor Cat Initiative, a wonderful website with all kinds of stuff on different behavior issues, providing for the indoor cat, all the needs, even has dog stuff as well on there as well. But that's a great website to go to be able to give you some tips on how to give your cat an enriched environment inside.
Yeah, and I think they live, what is it, almost twice as long?
Yeah, they do. I mean, a much longer period of time, just because of disease transmission, trauma, that type of thing. So it's better if you want your cat to live with you a long time, keep them indoors.
Spencer in Waukesha. Hello, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a question regarding my dog, who I'm fairly certain has luxating patella, because he limps around and I can honestly feel, I can rub his leg and sort of feel it sliding in and out of place. And I was wondering, I've been trying to research online what our options are as far as treatment. And I know there's a surgery, but the costs are sort of unclear to me. So I've been just exercising him more, and it seems to help, but it hasn't gone away completely. What? He's had this issue his entire life.
What breed is your dog?
Well, he is a mix. He's a German Shepherd, I believe, Ridgeback mix that we got from the Humane Society.
Okay. Well, first thing I would be recommending is you get a diagnosis, because, you know, we see luxating patellas in large breed dogs. Potentially, it tends to be more of a small breed dog problem, but right. We are seeing it in other breeds of dogs as well. And so getting a diagnosis would be helpful. When I hear a large breed dog, you know, I think they do have their own knee problems, like anterior cruciate ruptures, that type of thing. But the classic clinical signs of a dog with a luxating patella that's sliding in and out is they may be walking normally, and then all of a sudden they're holding their leg up, they're walking on three legs, and they kind of have to stretch the leg that they're holding up out a little bit, and it slides back in, and off they go again. So it's kind of an intermittent lameness. But we see different grades of patellar luxation, kneecap luxation, and it's graded on a scale of 1 to 4, where 1 is where it's in almost all the time and can slip out periodically but goes back in readily. Grade four is where it's out all the time. And those dogs are, you know, walk very strange because they throws the whole knee alignment off. And so they've got kind of either a bow-legged stance and are quite uncomfortable. Exercise is great, but if your dog has an unstable knee, that's going to degenerate degrade the cartilage even faster. So, you know, I don't want your dog to get overweight because that's going to make things worse, but be careful with the exercise. You may find that certain types of exercise like swimming may be very helpful, but hitting the pavement with an unstable knee is probably not in your dog's best interest. There's a number, depending on the degree of severity of the patellar luxation, it is something that has to be usually repaired surgically. If it's a low-grade patellar luxation, it happens intermittently, keeping your dog slender, not letting them jump up onto things because that's where they really stress those back legs when they're jumping. So avoiding frisbee and jumping up on the furniture, getting them on a joint supportive agent, glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, green lip muscle, all these, you know, different products that are out there. That may be helpful as well to just give the building blocks for the joint and keep it in a little bit healthier state. But if your dog has more severe issues, then you're looking at surgery. And there's a couple of different things that they can do. They can deepen the groove that the patella sits in. It's called a trochleoplasty. They can do some stitches on the side of the joint to kind of tighten the knee, the capsule up to keep the kneecap in. And sometimes if you've got like a grade four patellar luxation where it's out all the time, you're looking at actually removing the crest from the tibia and relocating it someplace else to kind of get everything back in alignment. Very major surgery, obviously. But so talk to your veterinarian, get an opinion from an orthopedic surgeon if you need one, and hopefully your dog has a grade one or two and it's going to live a long life without needing surgery.
There we go. Thanks, Spencer, for calling. Appreciate it very much. We have an email or a Facebook question from Garrett, who sent a really great photo, too, of one of his cats. This is one of our two cats named Sasha. The two cats are about 8 years old, and as you can see, getting a little chunky. We're wondering what's the best way to diet them. They will meow constantly if they don't get it fed enough. We also feed the higher-priced food. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, it's simple, very simple. Less calories, more exercise.
Fewer calories.
More exercise, yeah. And so here we've got this cat that's a couch or a chair potato. I want to see that cat up and moving. So simple things like feeding your cat all over the house, like putting little bowls of food on top of bookcases and inside boxes and making them hunt for a living may be helpful. I also recommend if you've got more than one cat that they be fed separately because it's really hard to control how much each cat's eating if they have a buffet open 24 hours a day. And I always use the analogy, if you go on a cruise ship where you can eat 24 hours a day, you never come home skinnier. Okay.
No. Never.
And so if that's the only thing they have to do is hunt that, you know, their food bowl, they're going to end up getting overweight. So, you know, come up with exercise routines for them. I like to see them meal fed. You may have to go to an automatic feeder. Sometimes we even have to resort to using things. There's a device that you can get online that's called the Meow Space, but you can actually make your own with a big storage tote and one of the little electronic cat doors that either reads their microchip or a magnet that they're wearing around their collar that will allow each cat to have their own little restaurant booth so that they can go in and out and eat all their food. When it comes to the meowing, that's your problem, okay? Eventually, if you give in when they're meowing, they've just learned, I've got to meow louder and longer, and then I'll get fed. If you just ignore them, they'll get worse, but eventually it will get better. They'll go through this thing called an extinction burst where they'll just be like really frantic, like feed me, feed me, feed me. And if you just ignore it, eventually they'll shut up, and that's when you can give them a little bit of food. And they'll learn, oh, you be quiet, you get to eat. So
there you go.
It's training the human and the cat. Yeah.
Sandy and Elroy, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask you about my daughter's purebred Australian Shepherd. He's only 2 years old, and he has lymphomic cancer, I believe. It's
lymphoma.
I was wondering, I heard the call earlier about checking out breeders. I'm not sure she did all the research she needed to do on this, because he kind of started out at a very young age with his head shaking. Is that, they told her that was kind of normal, and just to snap him out of it, that he would sit there and his head would shake from side to side.
Huh.
And now she's always exercised him very, very much and given him really good food. And I don't understand at this age. Is this something that Australians
have? Well, cancer is one of those things. I mean, if you look at even like in human children, why do some children develop cancer? I mean, it may be genetic. It could be environmental. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons out there, but we think that for many cases it is genetic. And that's where working with a breeder to say, hey, you know, what did grandpa die from or whatever? And so if you can find out, when my dog hit 10, I ended up finding the breed, his breeder, and because I adopted him as an adult dog, and I wanted to find out how that dog died, because as my dog got to be 10, it's like, well, look, you know what? And turned out his sire ended up dying because he got electrocuted for chewing on a refrigerator cord. So totally unrelated to any health issues, but except stupidity. But it's sad when we get these dogs in when they're so young. It's kind of like juvenile cancer, and people, you just, it's like, why is this, you know, on this wonderful dog? But there are good treatments for it. There's new treatments coming out, and work with an oncologist if you can to see if you can, you know, find out about any clinical trials or anything like that that may be going on to be able to help your dog have a happier life for as long as we can.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Jim and Menasha, thank you for calling. Do you have a quick question?
Yeah, I have a 3-year-old Rottweiler mix who seems to have a real bad skin problem. We have these cysts we've had removed probably like 3 times now, a total of 30 cysts. And the vet says they're harmless, but his skin is getting dry and flaky, and it's painful for him to be touched in certain areas now. And I'm just wondering if maybe he should change his diet or what.
Yeah, what I really worry about, there's a condition called sebaceous adenitis, which is an inherited skin problem that we see primarily in poodles. But since your dog is a mixed breed dog, it, you know, who knows what genetic material is in it. I would be strongly recommending, if you do get these things removed, have them biopsied so they can be looked at. And your dog may even need to have a skin biopsy now if they've got some painful issues going on, to rule out other things like skin cancer. There's a condition called mycosis fungoides that dogs can get, which is cutaneous lymphoma, and that can be very painful. So get, you know, back to your veterinarian, get this checked out, and definitely send off those samples to have them analyzed by a pathologist so you can get the right answer.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with Dr. Sandy. You stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Again, thank you so much for listening and really appreciate it. You have a question? You can join in. Call at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. Susan and Stevens Point is online with a question. So let's go there. Susan, hi. Thank you for calling. Susan, are you there? Well, Susan. Well, let's try Tali in Madison. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sandy.
Hello.
Well, we'd like to invite all of you folks, Dr. Sandy, I know you can't come, but all your listeners, to the 27th annual Badger Kennel Club's Wisconsin Dog Fair.
Why do you think I can't come? I've already planned on being there. I'm there every year.
Oh, because I heard a rumor that you weren't going to be able to attend this year.
No.
Great.
Yes.
I'm so happy that we have
you. I will be at the vet school's booth. And
awesome.
I will be there so people can stop by and visit me and learn about the School of Veterinary Medicine. Yeah.
Well, one of the important things we really want to get across to the listeners is this is primarily an educational event where participants, people coming on in, families, are going to be able to look at and talk to over 100 registered AKC breeds and their breeders.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a way for you to find out, is this dog right for your family? What kind of clearances do I need to get if I'm purchasing a puppy?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just wonderful. And you might find out that the dog that you thought was the dog of your dreams isn't. I know I have a Gordon Setter, and I have so many people who say, boy, I'd love to have one of those.
Yeah.
Well, are you ready to do 15 miles a day?
Mm-hmm. Right. You got it. And well, and I think that's the, you know, the more education you can have. I mean, people put more time into researching what car they're going to drive for the next 5 years than they do looking at a pet that's going to be with them and part of their family for 10 to 15 years or more. So it's a wonderful event. And thank you very much for bringing this up.
And where is it held, Sandy?
It's going to be at the Alion Energy Center. It's November 1st.
November 1st at the Alion Energy Center. And I think if you went to the Badger Kennel Club, probably you're going to find out all the information you need about that event on November 1st. Well, Tally, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. And it's the 27th annual
dog
fair.
Yeah.
So 27 years. So obviously it's been successful.
Mm-hmm.
Angie and Nina has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Angie.
Hi, thank you. I have a 3-year-old cockapoo that had 63 bladder stones removed about a month ago. Right. I called her, my vet, and I said, you know, when we're going for walks, she's like constantly stopping to pee. And she kept telling me, well, she's just marking her territory. And I've never had a female dog mark her territory.
They can.
When it got to be like such a problem that we couldn't even proceed very many feet without her stopping to try to pee, you know, I took her and they finally x-rayed her and they saw that her bladder was completely distended with all these stones.
Wow.
And it's the struvite.
Mm-hmm.
So they found that she also had a bladder infection. And so they put her on this Hill's, the science diet, the CD, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is there something else I can give her? She doesn't like this.
There are some other therapeutic diets that would be appropriate. You may want to just ask your veterinarian for a prescription for either, you know, something from Nestle Purina or Royal Canin.
Well, she had the Royal Canin first, and she wouldn't eat that either.
Yeah.
Really picky. And I'm like, to the point where she'll just sit there by her bowl, and I'm like, that's not a dog way to live.
Yeah, and you're trying the canned as well as the dry? Okay. You know, in some of these cases where we have a pet that needs a therapeutic diet and won't eat it, you may find that going with a veterinary nutritionist, working with a veterinary nutritionist, actually coming up with a home-prepared diet, that may be something that would be helpful to prevent this from returning in the future.
Right.
And we know that we'll see these types of stones in dogs that do get bladder infections, but we'll also see it be a genetic problem for them as well. And so some of them will just, even without an infection, continue to produce these stones. So it's really important that for lifetime, the rest of her life, she is monitored for these. But there's a company that is based in California called Balance It. And they will have board certified veterinary nutritionists, and there are other companies that will do this as well. And you can go to the veterinary nutrition, I'm trying to think of what their American Society of Veterinary Nutritionists website, and you'll be able to find other places that you can go to as well. But they would be able to, between you and your veterinarian, work with coming up with a home prepared diet that would meet your dog's needs to be able to produce the right acidity for the urine, the right mineral content, so that these stones won't form again. And that's the trick, is trying to come up with you know, the ingredients that are going to provide your dog with the appropriate pH and all those things that you need to prevent recurrence.
Right. Now, I got some pH strips. Is there a specific time of day that I should test this, or is it just like any time that I can catch her?
Any time you can catch it. It really doesn't make that much difference. But don't be just monitoring with that. I think that you also have to be looking at the magnesium levels in the food and different things like that too. So it's based on mineral and pH, and you're not going to be able to monitor that, the mineral content, with a little dipstick. So, yeah. That's going to be a tough one. So I'm sorry she's fussy. Most dogs will eat these foods without any trouble, but I think you're looking at homemade diet from now on.
Sorry, Angie, but thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have an email question from several email questions, actually, and some Facebook questions as well. Email from Christine. I have a 9-pound, 3-year-old poodle Maltese Terrier mix. Seems intolerant to any chewable or topically applied drugs, such as flea and tick medications and heartworm preventatives. He regurgitates within 10 minutes of any doses. Any suggestions? Are there any natural preventives?
Unfortunately, there are no natural heartworm preventatives out there. There is an injectable every 6 months heartworm preventative. I haven't used it in years. It was pulled off the market. It's back on now. It's called ProHeart. Very few veterinarians carry it, but that may be something. But the problem is you give it by injection, and if your dog doesn't tolerate it, what are you going to do? You've got, you know, this drug in their body for 6 months. There's so many different products out there. I mean, for flea control, one of the things that you may want to consider trying is there's a collar that the Bayer company makes called the Seresto collar. Very well tolerated, non-irritating, based on friction. The chemical is kind of released when the collar comes in contact with the hair. And I've had dogs that don't tolerate anything else tolerate that really well. Now, that's just going to be flea and tick. What are you going to do about heartworm preventative? And there are, you know, several different companies that are out there. And I wouldn't give up on it. I think that finding one, and it may be that you just can't go with a chewable tablet, that you have to find a regular, you know, a tablet that you just have to pill the dog with. And hopefully your veterinarian may be able to provide you with some samples of different things so you can do a trial. I think that the risk of not having your dog on something is pretty great. Not so much here, but if you travel with your dog, it's, you know, anywhere where you go south, it's a huge problem for them. I am now in the Madison area starting to see local dogs that have never left the area with heartworm disease. So we know we've got a reservoir here that are infecting our dogs. So you got to do the best you can, and it's just going to be trial and error until you find the right thing.
Email question from CJ. Could you recommend an herbal alternative to Rimadyl for elder dogs?
As a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, I can't think of anything that is a product that you'd be able to use that's going to be an herbal product. But that's, again, not my area of expertise. There are some other joint protective agents. There's some injectable medication. There's one that's called Adequin Canine, which is a polysulfated glycosaminoglycan that you do in a series and then get into doing it like on a quarterly basis after that. And some dogs tolerate that very well. The glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, green lip muscle, all those things, MSN, all these different things that are included in some of these joint supplements would be something that you may want to be looking into as well. But I really don't know of an alternative for a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory.
Could you, Ron wondered if you could suggest a pet chiropractor, and I don't know where Ron was from, so.
Yeah, I mean, there are more and more veterinarians getting certified and veterinary technicians in spinal manipulative therapy. We can't call it chiropractic in the veterinary world. Just in our area here in the Madison area, we've got several of them. I think that I would just go to, you know, Google veterinary chiropractic care and see who comes up. But it is a special certification that they have to go through. It's very long. It takes a couple of years to be certified to be able to do this. And so it's not an easy program, but we have some really great people in our area, including even at the veterinary school.
Kevin in Madison has a question for you. Hi, Kevin. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. Hey, Dr. Sandy. I have a question, kind of a part question. I'm hoping you can help to answer. I went to Dr. Roden for a cat behavioralist. She's been suggesting medication and ways to deal with my fiance's cat, who is just evil. Whenever I come in, hisses, yowls, growls, advances, She prescribed gabapentin, I think that's how you pronounce it. That didn't work. And now she's prescribing Taxol. And I was just curious if you know anything about that drug and the success that it might have.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really dangerous situation to be in. And we see cats that are like this. And I wish I could tell you why. But for a lot of times, it's just maybe lack of exposure to people early on in life. It may be genetic. So how much of it is environment? How much of it's genetic? Learned experience with having, bad experiences with people in the past. And so the cat becomes defensive. But really be careful with your own safety. Remember, 60% of cat bite wounds become seriously infected. And so you want to avoid scratches and bites as much as you possibly can. And what Paxil is it's a drug that is in the like Prozac family. It's used a lot for social anxieties in people. And so we do use it in cats. It's very well tolerated. And it's used as a once a day medication. So it's in a small tablet. So it's pretty easy to get down them, usually in things like pill pockets. Has very few side effects. Can take about 4 to 6 weeks to start taking some effect. Is it going to be the cure-all for this cat? Unlikely. What you'll probably be needing to do is work on behavior modification, meaning while she's, after the medication is already on board, having this kitty maybe in a room by itself where, you come by and you're already in the house, you're sitting down, maybe the cat gets to see you from a distance behind a screen door or a bunch of baby gates that it can't maneuver over. And, so it's just like you're not stressing the cat, you're not looking at the cat, you're not reaching for the cat, you're at a distance and nothing bad happens. And maybe then you can start tossing the cat special treats, or mom can give the kitty, flakes of tuna or lunch meat or whatever the cat really likes, and gradually have you move closer and closer. Is it going to work? I have no idea. How long is it going to take? Weeks, months. It may never happen. So you may be looking at this, maybe a situation where you might have to live with a cat in a room that you avoid just for your own safety. It's a tough situation to be
very
in. Sorry.
Tough. Sorry, Kevin. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call and good luck. Susan in Stevens Point has a question. Thank you, Susan. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I'm calling because we have a 15-year-old Beagle Sheltie mix that really is developing some severe arthritis. He's had a number of tick diseases, and I think that's really affected it. But he's on heart medications, he's on seizure medications, and it seems like almost anything we try to give him for pain, he has really bad reactions to. So I'm wondering, do you have any suggestions on some sort of medication that might help give him a better quality of life with that arthritis?
Well, it's really going to depend on kind of his overall health. There are some medications that we can't use because they would potentially make the seizures worse.
Mm-hmm.
There are some medications that may affect the kidneys or liver or the intestinal tract if he's got a sensitive intestinal tract. So it comes down to kind of sitting down with lab work and the dog in front of you to try to find something that may be beneficial to help the dog. I would be looking at this point, maybe considering some other treatment modalities, like talking to a physical therapist that may be able to help with giving you massages, exercises, things that may make your dog feel more comfortable and give that supportive soft tissue around those joints so you can maintain that and have the dog still be comfortable. It may mean working with a acupuncturist or a veterinary chiropractor, or I should say spinal manipulative therapist, okay, that would be able to help you to make your dog comfortable as well. And then it may involve just changing the environment to things like orthopedic foam beds that may have a heater in them so that they your dog can stay, you know, keep those joints a little more limber. This is a really tough one. You've got to approach it from so many different ways. I'm worried about making a recommendation of a drug with your dog having such a complex medical history. And
right.
Yeah, that's a tough one. But look into some of these other kind of alternative modalities. It may give your dog, twilight years, some comfort.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I'll do that.
Thank you
very much for calling. And John in Menominee, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sandy. A question about the possibility of training a family dog to become a therapy dog that could be used for warning for possible seizures.
Boy, it's always possible, but I would have to work with someone that actually does this type of work. I don't think this would be something you would probably be able to do on your own. It's, you know, certain dogs are just more in tune to different things. It's going to, involve kind of early training. Even something as simple as, can this dog be taken out into social environments where it will remain calm and quiet? And so, you know, just having that basic obedience under the dog's belt is, you know, going to be needed before you even get into doing any of the therapy work. But boy, oh boy, I don't even know how you would start training a dog to be able to do that. That's a new one on me, but I know it exists and they're able to do it. And are all dogs able to be trained? Who knows? I don't know, but I doubt it. I doubt it. Yeah, because it's
not all of them.
Yeah, because are they? I mean, my dogs couldn't care less. I mean, they'd be like, hey, you're home. I'm just going to stay in my bed. I don't even want to get up and say hi to you anymore. So yeah. So some breeds are just not very observant, and some are more active and not going to be as bonded to the person they're going to be training with. So. Find a group. I'm sure you can find the therapy dog groups online that you can pose this question to.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. There's a photo from Brenda. There's actually some nice photos up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. One here, though, Brenda has 9-year-old boxer diagnosed with degenerative myelopathy. Mm-hmm. And she's getting increasingly worse. What wondering about your thoughts on acupuncture or chiropractics?
Yeah, degenerative myelopathy is an inherited problem that dogs get. And dogs, breeds that are really prone to it, are actually doing genetic testing to make sure that they are not breeding dogs that are carrying this gene or, trying to, get rid of it, especially in German Shepherds. But boxers can be one of the dogs, the breeds that will get this as well. It's a very progressive loss of neurologic function, very similar to like Lou Gehrig's disease in people. And I wish there was some treatment for it. I really doubt that chiropractic would help, and I really doubt that acupuncture would help. I would talk to an acupuncturist to see if what their experience with this would be. To my knowledge, it's more, physical therapy to try to maintain as much muscle mass as you can, supportive therapy with carts and, walkers and booties to keep the feet from wearing out when they're walking. It's trying to improve the quality of life any way you can, but really no specific therapy.
Pat from East Troy, hello, thank you for calling. Do you have a quick question?
Yes, I have a golden who has had anxiety problems for 7 years that I know of, and she's been on doggy Prozac or fluoxetine. My problem with it is, I wonder if that's too long, because every once in a while, or about every 2 or 3 weeks, when I put my hand on her head, it almost burns my hand. Her head is so hot, her skull.
Wow.
Yeah, and that may, what I'd be saying is get her temperature. And it's very simple to take rectal temperatures in a dog. You can buy a thermometer inexpensively. Your veterinarian or a veterinary technician could show you how to do that. And I would take the dog's temperature to see, are they running a fever? Because that would be really important to know. But, it could be that your dog was just laying in the sun, or that, if they're excited, they may be a little hot if they were outside. So it may be nothing, but I would not be thinking that the anti-anxiety medication that you've had your dog on would be causing your dog to have intermittent bouts of hyperthermia. But check the temperature and see, because, it may be nothing. It may just be that your hands were cold, and with dogs' body temperature normally running around 101, 102, they always feel warm when you touch them. And with the head not having a lot of fur, it's going to feel warmer than other places on the body, which is why some of these breeds that are hairless are just so snuggly, because they're like your own personal, hot water bottle, because they don't have hair insulating them. And so you get their body temperature right next to yours.
And thanks very much for calling. And people have asked about appointments at the UW, and we're out of time. But if you go to our Facebook page, we have a link.
Okay, perfect. And they can call there. The phone number is area code 608-263-7600. That's the main desk, and they can direct you to the appropriate service.
263-7600.
Yep, 263-7600.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back in about a month, and we will talk with her again. Thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.